Weekly Politics, Podcast 15. This is Ben Smith from the New York Daily News, and I am podcasting this week from the Regency Hotel in Manhattan, where I sat down with Congressman Rahm Emanuel. He was at the Regency raising money for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, which he chairs, and is also promoting his new book, which is called The Plan, and which he co-wrote with Bruce Reed, the Clinton administration wonk. And we started out talking about the unusual number of contested congressional races in New York State this year.
The New York races.
Oh.
Can you rank them? I mean, you know.
You're not going to have me rank them.
Well, I'm just going to listen to the order in which you tell me about them.
Well, then I'll confuse you. Look, you have let's lay them out on the table first.
Mm-hmm.
You have Jack Davis and Tom Reynolds. You have Mike Arcuri and Senator Myers. We'll see if I know my geography then.
Yeah. The Chuck Schumer challenge.
Very good, Ben.
Can he? Yeah. I'm like a blank piece of paper.
Have you had him do
something
it?
Of them. He will do it at the drop of the hat.
Well, I'm not going to pass that Rorschach test.
Can you do that for Illinois?
I can do it for...
I wish I hadn't said that.
I can do it for all of northwest side of the city of Chicago, street by street, block by block. And then you have, obviously, Kirsten Gillibrand. And you have Eric Mastrace and Jan Mathasris. You have different demographics and capacity. And so the districts, some districts are more Democratic or more Republican. Some are better funded candidates than others. Others are better positioned. As you know, I mean, it doesn't take a, you know, and you're a smart guy, Ben. Open seats have a proclivity that incumbent seats don't have.
Right, and that's the Arcuri race.
That's the Bollard seat, which is in two separate public opinions for races. Mike's in very good shape. And a very strong candidate. Kirsten has run her new ad on education is fabulous, and her one about the president is really excellent, about energy prices, etc. So I say that all with the sense that there are different opportunities. I'm not going to rank them for you because it's just not fair to the candidates, and then what I say to you gets used for fundraising purposes one against the other, and it just... More work for me after this interview. My big joke is I used to have three, as you know, competitive brothers, and I used to accuse my mother of loving Ezekiel more than she loved me. She said, "No, I hate you all equally." So I am not. I have a lot of people who, look, I'm here. I'm doing an event for Kirsten while I'm here. I'm doing an event for Corey while I'm here. I did an event last night for. Chris Murphy. I'm doing an event for Dan Maffei while I'm here. I'm doing an event for Linda Stender while I'm here. And something for Diane Farrell. So I'm using my time to help all our candidates as I can. I wouldn't be, you know, and I also was just recently up, did something for Corey Maffei, Gillibrand, and Massa about within the month.
You disappointed that Pacella doesn't have a serious challenger?
Disappointed?
Yeah.
It's, we try to recruit, I think a number of candidates wanted to do it. Two in particular come to mind. They really wanted to do it. It just wasn't what it was for them in their professional lives at this point. And I understand that.
When did you get the sense that this was going to be like a different kind of year? Just because, I mean, just, you know, covering the races here, there are like serious people raising real amounts of money for the first time in memory in a lot of these districts. I mean, like, regardless of whether you want to eat this, was it obvious from 2004? Like, when did you start as chair of the Detroit?
December of 2004. I mean, I suppose you could say the photo went up on the wall January of 2005. I don't even think that. I don't even care. But, Nancy called me. We were in a... we're fine.
I think we're fine. Thank you.
Did you want anything?
No.
But one of the things in history, one of the things that we try to do, and this is a circuitous way of answering your question, is... Every major midterm election has been a nationalized midterm election. 74, 70 plus seats, Watergate. 1982, Ronald Reagan's recession, 20 plus seats in the House. 86, the Democrats took back the Senate. 94, Our inability to deliver on health care cost us the House and Senate. And then even in 1998, when the Democrats regained, when the Democrats made gains in the sixth year of a presidency for a party in power, which had not been done in over 100 years, they were all nationalized midterm elections. Now, this is something I've talked to, I convinced our party elders, but it took some convincing of people, and I also believe you needed a national election if you were going to surmount a serious challenge to a gerrymandered map where basically the fix was in.
Right.
Now, did I think we could nationalize it? I thought from day one we could nationalize it, but you had to have the courage to have a strategy, and B, what were you going to nationalize it about? And as I said, and you can go back to almost 14 and 15 months ago, the American people were tired of this endless occupation, this wageless recovery, and that there was going to be a growing sense that nothing George Bush had put in place from a policy level, either here at home or abroad, was going to alter a course that was on a trajectory where people were getting both turned off by, angry about, and frustrated with. And so now, I think some people, the very people that now are, you could call it frothy, optimistic, or better than 50-50, you know, whatever, were the same people that 14 and a half months ago said the Democratic Party was a permanent minority party. That's not as an attempt to jab them.
Right.
I say fortunes turn very quickly in politics. So I'm not ready. I'm not where everybody else is. I was not where everybody was before when they were despondent. I'm not where everybody else is today where they're in a exuberant mood. I will know, in about, let's just call it 4 weeks from today, you and I are going to have a better sense about the next 6 weeks than we are about the last 6 weeks.
And so your book, you have this plan book, and I asked Charlie Rangel, because I ran into him yesterday, and he sort of said, he's raising a lot of money, and, you know, I guess there's this book, but you can't expect any two Democrats to read one book, and, you know, that's never going to happen. And I'm a little confused about what sort of a book document it is. I mean, is this something you're expecting, you want candidates to sign onto? In sort of contract? Because that was sort of the Contract of America.
This was not intended for that. If you're looking for your analogy.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking for.
Well, what are the two guys that wrote it did? Bruce Reed wrote Putting People First, and Rahm Emanuel helped implement Putting People First. So your best analogy is Putting People First. And two guys who take
which great cycle was Putting People First?
92 election.
That was the first one, right?
Yeah. It was Bill Clinton's Bruce Reed both fought a lot of the, obviously Bill Clinton did too, but and helped and literally wrote it for Clinton, with Clinton and Gore. And so if you thought of that, it's not in the so much as a it's not modeled on 94, it's modeled on what was a very successful both not only campaign but presidency, in my view, from what helped move this country forward and building for the 21st century. So that's the model that we use. And again, one of the things that we try to do in this, it was not meant for seven think tanks around DuPont Circle and a couple columnists. It was meant, and which is why we wrote it, so it's accessible to people. It's about their lives, so you better, if it's about their lives, they got to be able to understand it. And so that's what it's written in that fashion. And most important, that's stylistically, but the most important thing is not any one of the policy things, but the notion of the philosophy of what we say in there is that citizenship is not an entitlement program. It comes with responsibility. Whether you look at Peace Corps or AmeriCorps, two ideas that started, that changed a philosophy and a culture. You looked at welfare reform. What do they all have in common? That you have to take responsibility before the doors of opportunity are open. Citizenship is not an entitlement program. And if you start like that, all your major economic and social questions can be at least begun to be tackled.
I wondered whether.
See, I don't think Charlie's reading it on the summer break, huh?
Evidently not.
It's okay.
He's pretty committed to this. He seems to winning back the House.
Absolutely.
He's totally obsessed with it.
He has done. If I had 10 Charlie Rangels, I would sleep a lot easier at night. He does a great job.
In terms of fundraising?
Not just anything you ask him to do.
Right. But so I guess I wonder whether the book was like a shot in the party civil war. I mean, you know, it was sort of taken that way, certainly by, like, you know, my DD. And I think you had been to some degree kind of a, like a darling of the like Daily Coast crowd.
The what?
The Daily Coast crowd.
Oh.
To some degree now, and I mean, but this seemed like you were, you know, it was very New Democrat, very very Clintonite.
Well,
and you know, I mean, and actually, you quoted Peter Beinart a lot, who talks about, you know, the need for a civil war, basically, the need for a purge.
No, if anything, that's consensus building. I think, look, there's enough politics. One of the things I think we say in the book, and I really strongly believe in, the one casualty the American people would have taken in the war on terror was partisanship, and that's the one that's the one victim George Bush won't give, which is he loves this divisive politics. This is not meant for an internal party debate. I understand, and I don't think Peter wants that. He has a clear view. We are, and I've always been, a New Democrat. But to me, this is where I part with my New Democrat friends. I am not interested in an interesting warfare inside the party.
Yet or ever?
No, I believe that the real debate is about going forward, not backwards. It's not about left versus right. And there are going to be great ideas on the quote-unquote progressive side. There are going to be great ideas on the quote-unquote New Democrat centrist side. And the question is, do they help tackle the problems? If they do, they'll move us forward. Now, is universal health care a left or center position? I think the Democratic Party accepts that idea from Franklin Roosevelt forward. We gave you, here's the politics of what happens in health care. We have failed. Four presidents have failed at universal health care for the population.
But
we have succeeded at universalizing health care for populations, seniors, poor, veterans, children of uninsured. Take that as your example. That is what the system can sustain and accomplish. And then go for a universal kids care program. Go for an early buy-in to Medicare by early retirees at a higher premium and help stabilize Medicare and provide health care for the fastest growing uninsured group in America. And then target small businesses. And it gets you on the road towards a universal package. If you were designing a healthcare system today from scratch, you wouldn't design the one we have. You wouldn't. We have it. We've never been able to undo it, change it. What we have been able to do is succeed at universalizing healthcare for segments. And so that's what it's written about. This is not... the only shot is towards two people who argue, write books that, and put down thoughts that don't address the problem. Democrats, as we say in there, are hired to solve problems and to tackle it. And I represent a blue-collar district and a working-class bungalow belt district. And it also has the wealthy coast, lakefront. You can see the dynamics and the opportunities of the global economy, and you can see the intense pressure of a global economy. I represent 20,000 flight attendants and machinists who all had a guaranteed pension, who don't anymore, who had X on wages, who don't anymore. Okay, now what do we do to make sure that we have a social contract, economic contract, that is as successful for the next 40 years that the quote-unquote GI Bill and investment strategy where you had kind of the one mortgage, one job, one pension program for the last 40 years. That doesn't happen anymore. So what do you got to do to update your policies and your and investments to ensure that the success of the future is as rewarding as the last 40 years?
And do you, I mean, without it being a sort of contract with the, you know, House Democrats,
yeah.
I mean, do you feel like this is something that, that a Democratic House, you know, from the universal service idea through to the, is something that, talked to Nancy Pelosi about? Is this going to happen when you guys win?
No, I mean, it's not, my view is there's going to be a lot of things in there that Democratic candidates for president are going to talk about. But look, we have in there the minimum wage. This new direction for the Democrats exists. We have in there direct negotiations for prescription drug prices. That's also part of the new direction 6 and 06. We have in there, as you know, the 9/11 Commission recommendations. So there's a lot of overlap. There's not the basic goals agreement. This was, if all this does is only try to do, that's not accomplishable in one election cycle. It's not. And it wasn't intended for that type of only short-term piece.
I meant to ask you about the universal service piece of the plan. Can you tell me about it? Like, how's this going to work? Are people going to live in barracks?
That's not... Look, first of all, let's take two steps back.
Yeah.
We as a party. And it starts with the philosophy, as I said, of citizenship is not an entitlement program. You look at both the Peace Corps and the AmeriCorps, two efforts by past Democratic presidents to call forward people to serve their country in a capacity. And that, to me, both Peace Corps and AmeriCorps were unbelievably successful initiatives. At the height of it, I think the AmeriCorps had like 400+ thousand kids involved. The goal here is understanding the challenges of the war on terror. You know, at the height of the Cold War, the very early days, I'm sorry for starting up again, Truman actually thought of this. And as an attempt to show the Soviets at that time that we were ready for the long game here, and we knew that this was going to be a long twilight struggle, and we were going to do it. Didn't end up doing it.
It was a similar...
It was a universal civil defense training. And so, you know, I think he had it at 18, but we were saying somewhere at the ages of 18 to 25, you will do 3 months of training. You can do it in between your college. At some point in college, you just do that. First of all, it tackles fear because you have some sense of a plan. Which what the terrorists play, you know, basically play on is that nobody knows what they're going to do in a moment of crisis. You know, God forbid the levees break again. We'll have some idea of how to do, you know, move people out, how to have some sense of prepared a community as well as a group of citizens to work with local law enforcement and emergency workers on what to do. So that's number one. So you have an actual plan, you have actual people in place, and you have people who train. And I think an additional benefit is we all know that our diversity is either going to be an unbelievable asset as a society or a liability. It has historically been an asset. But there could be nothing wrong with all Americans having a joint, similar experience of what we call civil defense training or civil service or some sense of service to country and preparation, which will give people a sense of what it means to be an American. And that common experience will help us as a country. And it's not accidental. And at every period of time in American history, the most common being after World War II, where you had some sense of universal service, that was in the military, that America's march on civil rights began. So it is, we proposed 3 months. You know, at the end of the day, somebody says it should be 4. I'm not going to sit here and hang up over
it. It's a lot more than the U.S. government asks of anybody right now. I mean, I guess you could argue that from taxes.
No, it's because we have a lot more. We have a lot more challenges. So you're going to need a lot to do it. But you would agree after the 9/11, Americans stood ready to do something to help their country. Nobody asked. It was not people, not just from donating blood, but that was one example. People were ready to do something, looking for an answer that they wanted to do something. Now, some people enlisted in the Army. Some people donated blood. But there was a great sense that they were ready, and the call never came out.
I don't mean to
get that. And at every point in our party's history, Roosevelt, Kennedy, to Clinton, there was some type of service and some type of commitment you had to make to the country.
What
and
was
I think
Clinton being AmeriCorps?
Yeah.
Which is voluntary.
Right. So this is different.
So, but I guess I don't mean to get, like, hung up on kind of the aesthetics of it, but, like, uniforms and people who do, like, Europe, people get, you know.
If you're worried about doing, if you're worried that you're
going
to do 50 jumping jacks, the answer is yes.
Right. No, but I mean, is it, are you kind of shipping the, you through the country out to army bases in the summers? I mean, I'm sort of, like, I wonder how it's going to work. I mean, this is people's experience. I'm sort of, like, it's so abstract. So is it going to be, like.
Well, it could be worked through.
Like, you can't, you know, you just, you know, it's like you go 9 to 5 to some course in the Red Cross building.
Well, I mean, that will be, that the whole idea there is it will be worked out. You could do it through your state National Guard could be the vehicle for that. That, you know, the goal here wasn't to sit here and work out a piece of legislation for you and all that, but that would be, that's one venue to doing it. Okay.
And would it, I mean, I guess, would it, are you shipping, I mean, some sort of, like, I'm a little hung up on the barracks. Like,
is there a reason? Do you want to talk about it? Do you think maybe...
I've got to turn the tape recorder off.
Let me ask you a question. Do you have Blue Cross Blue Shield coverage on this? Are you worried about this in some capacity?
No, I'm just curious. I'm just trying to sort of imagine it.
Well, rather than figure out whether you take a train ride or a barrack, think of it this way. There'll be a common experience, and you'll be prepared, God forbid, that No, thanks. God forbid that there's a chemical hit, there's another terrorist act, or a natural disaster, which are coming more frequently. There'll be a body of citizens who are ready and capable and trained. That's all you got to think about.
Yeah, they have this initiative, ready.gov or something. I mean, that's just national, but the New York City government periodically pushes that everybody's supposed to have something called a go bag in case you just need to go by the door.
You worry about that from a train ride and barrack perspective?
Nobody does.
Is your bag ready?
No. Do you have one? Do you have any sort of personal civil defense readiness going on?
We have basic supplies on water and stuff like that. Yeah.
You live in the city of Chicago?
Correct.
I know, we all should, I suppose.
We're all here for you, okay? It's a circle of love.
Anyway, I mean, it's just, you kind of want to know how these things will work. I mean, I'm of age, though I may not appear as, I'm actually barely out of your age bracket, so I'm...
Don't worry, it ain't going to happen on the first week of the Democratic Congress.
Not the first priority. What is the first priority of the Democratic Congress? I mean, and do you think there'll be sort of a...
Minimum wage vote. First vote. After, you know, all the procedural stuff. There'll be a vote on the minimum wage to raise it.
There's already a little push and pull about how much of it should be about, but not impeaching George Bush.
So no.
Like, investigate. I mean, that there's not really a...
No. Will you have a Congress that does oversight? Sure. Could be, you know, guess what? Our constituents are asking a lot of questions they'd like to have answers to. Like, how is it that $10 billion are missing in Iraq and nobody knows where it went? How is it that Katrina has all these empty trailers that were all built, bought, and paid for, and people are homeless with these and so are these trailers, $1.8 billion? How is it the Department of Homeland Security offers this money out to companies who have no accounting of where the money is going? So, will there be oversight? Oh, yeah. There'll be oversight. Is that going to be, you know, the only thing? No, we're going to pass a minimum wage increase. We're going to walk and chew gum. We're going to do both. We're going to handle it all.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of The Weekly Politics. You can read more politics at blogs.nydailynews.com/dailypolitics or by paying 50 cents for the New York Daily News or, you know, in many other ways.